very warm welcome to this special edition of our North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest podcast to mark International Women's Day. So welcome from me, Dr. Julie Jones, and as always, I'm here with my podcast partner, Helga McFarlane. And joining us all the way from Ireland, we're delighted to have a lady who has become a worldwide advocate for women in Parkinson. And I personally am delighted finally to meet Rochelle face-to-face and have this conversation. Helga, I'll hand over to you.
Thank you. Rochelle Flanagan, a state registered dietitian from Dublin, was expecting her second child when she was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's disease 7 years ago. Since then, she has become passionate about the unmet needs of women with Parkinson's. She co-founded the Women's Parkinson's Project to, in their own words, raise their voices for better treatment and research specifically for women. And she's also one of the driving forces behind the launch of a digital Parkinson's self-care app called My Moves Matter. A very warm welcome to you, Rochelle. It's lovely to see you in person. I've seen you so many times in the webinars and speaking at the World Parkinson's Congress on screen and things. So it's very nice to have you with us. We know how busy you are.
Oh, thanks a million. Look, it's brilliant to meet two other amazing advocates in Parkinson's, you know, in terms of all that you're doing. And I'm grateful for having the opportunity to you know, have another platform to raise awareness of the differences, you know, that women with Parkinson's have living with this lovely disease.
Three women discussing women and Parkinson's.
Yeah, make sure you're seatbelted in and ready to go.
Yeah, and look, you know, what's really great is when I started this journey of research into women's, I did my first kind of, you know, interview with a lady called Maria Teresa Ferretti, who was the chief science officer for the Women's Brain Project 3 years ago, I think it is now. And then we followed that up last year. We had a webinar for International Women's Day with a number of women with Parkinson's and also researchers. So it's great to see that that's expanded out now and that you're taking it on for International Women's Day, because the more of us who do it, the more awareness is raised. And International Women's Day is a great opportunity to do that, you know. So
we have to have a special welcome for any men that are listening, though, of course.
You know, I think there's two important points there, that, you know, this is not about women over men, or it's actually about, you know, personalized care for people with Parkinson's based on their gender. So there's definitely issues in terms of men that are different to women that need, you know, more personalized, you know, interventions. But also, I think in terms of, there's such a paucity of research around women that could potentially have a lot of answers for men too in terms of drug development. So, you know, it's and also it's with the other thing is that partners of women with Parkinson's, I think it's important for them to understand the differences, you know. So if you think of, you know, men, how they cope around women with, you know, PMS and menopause in general, you know, and a lot of discourse has happened around that. So I think it's helpful for partners, you know, and, you know, sons, daughters or whatever, to understand the impact of hormones on women with Parkinson's or other health issues, you know.
Possibly a good place to start is we should really mention the actual known incidence between men and women.
Yeah, and this has kind of been a bugbear of mine and many other women with Parkinson's, is that, you know, the image is portrayed as, you know, an older white gentleman stooped over with a tremor, and we know that the image is actually quite different. We know also that's really frustrating is that, you know, that image is used often in research, in presentations, and also that it's often bandied that, you know, it's twice as high in men than women. But when, you know, I started looking at the research and the numbers, it actually is, you know, 60-40. So it's not quite twice, I don't think, you know, 60-40% is a quite a substantial amount. And actually, they kind of reckon that that might actually be under the actual number because of women potentially being picked up later. And also, which is very interesting, is that when you compare to some countries in the eastern part of the world, women are actually higher presentation of Parkinson's than men. So there is differences, and whether it's genetic or, you know, phenotypic, you know, an environmental aspect We don't know, and we need more research.
To what extent is there formal research? I mean, if you had to put a balance on it, again, you've said a 60-40 split men to women with Parkinson's. Where would you say that sits within the formal published research, that balance between men and women?
We actually, I co-authored a paper with Indu Subramanian and Professor Elena Morrow and another neurologist, and then, you know, two other women with Parkinson's. And in that, we looked at the sort of, you know, the amount of research that was done. And actually, if there's less research looking at women with Parkinson's, and also in general, sex and gender in neurology is underrepresented, or women are underrepresented in neurology research in general.
So what do we know from the little research that there has been that you know of? What do we know about any differences in the disease? I mean, differences in the way perhaps the medication absorbs? What do we actually know?
As I mentioned, we had, you know, done this paper on the unmet needs of women with Parkinson's, and you know, it was really interesting looking at the research that had been out there. And it basically showed that in terms of non-motor symptoms, that women suffer from more mood, sleep disturbances, anxiety and depression, fatigue and apathy, pain and neurogenital symptoms. And on the flip side, women suffer less from cognitive impairment, hallucinations, GI symptoms, although I would question that, and sexual dysfunction. And also in terms of motor symptoms, then women tend to be more tremor dominant, have more facial masking, levodopa induced dyskinesia, and restless leg syndrome. And the restless leg syndrome is a really interesting, because I think that's something that's under looked at. And the levodopa induced dyskinesia, I have a whole bugbear around that. And I suppose in terms of facial masking, I wonder, you know, there is some research to show that impacts women, because we are seen to be the kind of smiley, keep everyone happy, you know. And it was really interesting, you know, before I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, my son used to say to me, "Mom, you don't smile as much anymore." It was only then afterwards when I learned about it, I was going, oh my gosh, you know, he noticed it before I noticed it. But it's just that society expects us as mothers to be, you know, where I don't think maybe that is expected as men, for men as much. So, you know, that might be more of a gender issue in terms of how it's reported that women have more of that. And we are seen to basically progress less fast than men do. However, the research would show that women suffer with Parkinson's with more disability than men do. And I don't know whether that's also because women tend to live longer with the condition, so possibly have more disability as a result. So they're the kind of main sort of non-motor motor. And then in terms of psychosocial issues, women tend to have more psychological distress, self-reported disability. Their health related quality of life at presentation or diagnosis tends to be lower. They have a negative destructive self-image, a loss of femininity, impaired sexual intimacy, definitely a feeling of not being heard. And, you know, often women downplay their symptoms because, you know, it's a bit like menopause. You know, when you keep on getting put down about, you know, that's not, you know, don't worry about that, it's just your hormones, you kind of stop and start to play it down, thinking, oh, maybe it is in my head. And also a really big thing in terms of differences, women get less social support. So women tend to attend their appointments on their own more than men do. So kind of, you know, it's quite common that women will go along with their partner and be the voice, but men don't tend to do the same thing for women. And also because women, there's a high percentage of women who live alone or outlive their partners. So again, there's more isolation from that point of view as well. So there are a lot of differences between the two based on sex and gender, in terms of gender norms, I suppose.
Do we have any idea at all why there are these differences? Is it hormonal? I know women can present slightly differently with heart attacks.
Like, it makes sense, as you mentioned there about, you know, cardiology. They're only discovering now that women present heart attacks completely differently to men, and often as a result die because, you know, they're sent home because they don't recognize that women don't have the typical, you know, pain in the arm, pain in the chest type symptoms. And also they've found now with cardiology drugs that women absorb them. more, and that can have more sort of impact. So similarly, in terms of Parkinson's, you know, we need that sort of focus as well. In terms of why, there are, based on sex, you know, there are definite differences in our metabolism, you know, in terms of drugs, for example. And then in terms of gender, I think it's more in terms of society and how health professionals and doctors sort of tend to dismiss women around their. And I think that's, again, the positive thing about the whole awareness of menopause. I think it started to really raise that awareness that, you know, it's not just in women's heads. So I think there's two angles that cause the differences, both sex and gender.
I find that really fascinating to know that perhaps women present differently, maybe due to the phenotype or the changes in pathophysiology that women experience are slightly different. But I suppose something we do know from other conditions is women respond differently to long-term condition diagnosis, perhaps compared to men, and how they're sort of more from an emotional point of view as well. And it is, you know, different people respond differently. And, you know, I've got people that certainly have said to me, it's been a relief being diagnosed, and now that I'm diagnosed, I can deal with it. And yet, and at the same time, I really appreciate that some people have, you know, perhaps have had a horrific experience of diagnosis, and psychologically it takes them a long time to be able to come to terms with that. And many people never do, depending on their experiences with their healthcare professionals. So it's interesting to see that there might be primary differences related to the pathology, but also secondary, just based on our individual characteristics. And I suppose that's probably true for men and women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as I say, in terms of the, you know, the menopause being a kind of classic example for women, you know, it's a difficult time because there's so many symptoms that actually are similar to Parkinson's. So there's the whole issue there in terms of, you know, having, say, fluctuating mood anyway, and then, you know, your symptoms of Parkinson's potentially, and trying to tease that out to get the right diagnosis. But, you know, I suppose one of the areas that, you know, really fascinated me was, you know, in terms of my own experience, you know, of being pregnant, 3 months pregnant, when I picked up my own Parkinson's diagnosis, and was actually, you know, working in my dietetic clinic. And the patient came to see me after a 5-year break, and I was writing in my record card, and I noticed that my handwriting was a lot smaller than it had been 5 years prior. And I never noticed that, because obviously progressively sometimes you don't notice things. But when you have that gap, I was like, oh, okay, that's a bit strange. But when I tried to make the writing bigger, I couldn't. And I thought, that's really strange. And when I looked up, you know, for the symptom, the only thing that kept coming up was micrographia, and the only thing associated with it was Parkinson's. And I kind of thought to myself, because I'd seen people with Parkinson's, but again, they're the stereotypical older white male. But I said, right, I'm going to ask for a referral to a neurologist. And, you know, he sort of said, well, you're very healthy. You know, my pregnancy was going fine. And literally the micrographia was the only symptom, plus a bit of an ache in my arm. It wasn't frozen shoulder as such. But I had to wait until my daughter was born and I finished breastfeeding before I could have a DAT scan to confirm it. And I suppose that's something that I noticed in terms of younger onset people, both men and women, is that we've all been put through trapped nerve tests and, you know, brain scans, which cost the system a lot of money. But also in terms of the DAT scan, you know, it was kind of psychologically quite hard to have to wait through, you know, my whole pregnancy, the birth and breastfeeding before I could get my diagnosis and start medication, you know. So, you know, that alone really should be changed. I think in the States, we have some places to do biopsies, skin biopsies to kind of do diagnosis. So, and I know obviously that like MJ Fox are trying to develop, you know, have developed a biomarker. So I think that would be helpful in terms of people getting an earlier diagnosis. But I suppose the other thing then in terms of the hormones was that I noticed after I started menstruating again that my symptoms got worse around my menstrual bleed. And I thought, and I was talking to actually some friends that I met through the WPC, women as well, and noticing that they were, you know, having the same problem. And I thought, that's interesting. And obviously with my science hat on, I was like, I wonder what's going on there. So we decided to do a survey of women who are with Parkinson's who are still menstruating, whether they notice the same thing. And, you know, 70-odd% of women said that they noticed fluctuations around their menstrual cycle as well. And actually 84% of them the week before their menstrual bleed, and about 49% during their bleed, and then a small percent after that. So that was very strong validation of what we were feeling ourselves personally. And that kind of set the seed in terms of a lot of research looking into this area. So a number of other research people have done research subsequently. So there was Val Helperin, which is a Spanish group, did research, and they corroborated what we found in our survey. And then we also worked with Michael J. Fox. They now have a survey on their Insight platform for women to take part in. So definitely encourage women to sign up for the Insight platform in general. So I do it myself. And basically you track your symptoms, you know, they send you a survey every, you know, it's 3 months or something. And so you're helping in terms of the general research. But once you take part in that, you then can get access to the women's surveys. And there's three different surveys at the moment, and we'll probably have others coming. But they also replicated what we saw. So definitely, you know, retrospectively, we are seeing through surveys that this is an issue, you know. So and then I suppose that the question is, why is it an issue? And this is, you know, interesting, I think, in terms of, so what happens before your menstrual bleed, your estrogen levels and your progesterone levels drop. So there's a theory that, you know, everyone's focusing on estrogen, that it's the estrogen drop. And in the brain, there are lots of estrogen receptors. So they feel there's something going on there in terms of, you know, either it's the drop of estrogen is causing a drop in dopamine further, or there's something going on with the actual receptors. Who knows? Because there hasn't been much research done on it. But if you think about it, in terms of premenstrual syndrome, like PMS, so I'm sure you can remember having that. Like the symptoms were brain fog, hard to concentrate, irritable, you know, might be bowel issues, you know, a number of things that are quite common in Parkinson's. And what happens with that estrogen, it causes a drop in the dopamine. So people who don't have Parkinson's, possibly it is a neurotransmitter issue, but obviously they don't have a lack of dopamine to start with. So not starting from a lower baseline. So that's a big difference between men and women. So you've got some women who are literally 2 weeks out of every month since their diagnosis in Parkinson's, and they're diagnosed in their 20s. That's a long time to have a double whammy of worse symptoms.
I think it's hugely fascinating. And, you know, I've been a physio for years, but women's health has never really focused on these particular elements. And I think it's really interesting that this has been, you know, through your work has really been highlighted the issues. I mean, we think about there's some elite sports women have come out and really talked about here in the UK, have talked about how, you know, their monthly periods really impact on their performance. And this is amongst elite athletes. So it's not really surprising that perhaps then we're seeing this, you know, also in people with Parkinson's. And as you say, if it is dopamine, the hormone has a negative impact on dopamine, then if you already have lower levels, you would perhaps therefore expect an exaggerated response. And so that actually just suddenly opens up a minefield then in terms of some women having that double whammy of, you know, menopause plus Parkinson's. And you just wonder, again, you know, as you were saying, many women are often not diagnosed till later. And perhaps because menopause, it isn't something that follows a pattern. It's kind of, it's here, there and everywhere, and your hormones are up and down. It perhaps maybe explains why we're not maybe picking up women diagnosis of Parkinson's until much later, when they're at their, maybe in their early 60s, when they think actually menopause should be done by now. And yet I still seem to have these issues seem to be staying with me. I think this is it's a really, really fascinating area. And then you just wonder about what happens when we add more dopamine into the system and the interaction that has with the existing hormone levels.
Well, that's, you know, what, so we kind of asked, you know, what are people doing? You know, there's no guidelines to help manage women with this. So we know anecdotally some neurologists are giving women extra levodopa to try and, you know, boost them, and that has helped some women. But we know some women are put on the oral contraceptive pill with no break. So basically, normally when you take the OCP or whatever contraception that has estrogen in it, they stop for weeks so you can have a bleed, so your estrogen drops. And we know that some women who are put on a, you know, continual, don't have a break, don't have as bad symptoms as women who take that break. So that seems to help women. But again, we don't know in terms of, you know, the research behind that. It's just, so neurologists, you know, some are just like, there's no guidelines, so I don't know what to do. That's kind of, you know, and one of the things that really shockingly came out of our survey was that roughly 90% of neurologists basically didn't discuss hormones with women in relation to Parkinson's, didn't discuss hormone therapies. You know, that is a big problem, because just because you have Parkinson's doesn't mean you stop being a woman and having those impacts. So that's, you know, a real concern. And, you know, interesting on that side with regard to the hormones, you know, one of the things that I have been working on, and you mentioned about My Moves Matter, it's sort of the app that I've developed. The beginnings of that was actually to do with this very point, is how do we get prospective data to be able to prove what women retrospectively were reporting in surveys? And it was actually through the paper that we wrote that we identified, well, actually, we need to have some means of women being able to track their Parkinson's symptoms across their menstrual cycle, so that they can use it to advocate for themselves with their clinician, and also use it to sort of, you know, compile research. So that's, you know, basically after 2 years, we are about to launch a study using the app around Europe through University College Cork, recruiting women who are still menstruating, but actually we will be looking for women who aren't, as a control as well. So we'll be looking to sort of see the difference between, you know, premenopausal, postmenopausal, but obviously the main focus is on the period. So women can, on the My Moves Matter app, they can track their symptoms, and they include not only Parkinson's symptoms but hormonal kind of symptoms, and they can also track their period as well, so that we can kind of get data. And also, we've done it through the app because obviously YOPD women is a smaller kind of cohort. So, you know, allowing it to women to do as they're busy with working and jobs, kids, looking after parents, whatever's going on. So it allows them remotely to take part in a study as well. So really excited about that. You know, it's taken us, you know, 2 years to get the app to this stage, and it's taken us a year to actually get the study. I never realized it took so long to get ethical approval for something. So it's like, you know, I feel like another baby has been born. But I'm kind of anxious, you know, that we get enough women and that we you know, we'll be able to see the data. But obviously, that, you know, the proof will be in the research pudding.
I suppose, yeah. I might be putting you on the spot here, and do please, by all means, if I am. I suppose we've always thought of Parkinson's, when you look at the sort of the Venn diagram about the risks, then we always talk about age, genetics, and environment. Is there, do we even know yet? Do we think hormonal issues could be then joined to that in the future, or are we still, is it far too early to say at this moment?
There's some research showing that women who have an oophorectomy have a higher risk of Parkinson's. So there's research to show a direct link between them. And then women who have hysterectomy, it's sort of, some say yes, some say no. But I think it's, again, oophorectomy is where you're getting rid of the ovaries, and so you don't have the hormone. So they should be put on HRT. And so when they're put on HRT, the risk disappears or reduces a lot. So there is there a kind of a sexual genetic, or I don't know if it's genetic, but it's a sex hormone related risk, without a shadow of a doubt. In terms of, you know, there's lots of research out there saying that potentially estrogen is neuroprotective. So, you know, and that might be, again, why it is that some women don't develop Parkinson's. It's a bit like Alzheimer's. Why do some women not develop Alzheimer's? But some women do. And I suppose I have my own theory and my own experience. Interesting enough, after my first pregnancy, I developed celiac disease. And on my second pregnancy, I developed Parkinson's. So I personally, on an N case of one, feel that, you know, there's a whole gut brain sort of, that it sometimes can be that, you know, there's different triggers. And pregnancy is one of the biggest inflammatory kind of overloads of your body. And it's quite common to develop the likes of celiac or underactive thyroid post-pregnancy in women. So, you know, whether there is a kind of inflammatory, and I know lots of young onset women where their diagnosis has been in and around their pregnancies. So there's a lot, I think, we need to tease out about that. Yeah.
I think that's been one of the fascinating things when Helga and I have been doing these pods now for over a year. And, you know, some people get frustrated that there hasn't been a big Parkinson's breakthrough. But from all the pods that we've done, and we've had, you know, basic cell scientists through to genetics, people who are researching genetics, what it strikes me is maybe there hasn't been the breakthrough that, of course, everybody wants in relation to cure. But what it is demonstrating it is that Parkinson's is far more complex than we ever thought it was. And actually, science is really moving forwards, but perhaps going in a straight line, what we're sort of see, there's so many more avenues to it. And Parkinson's isn't just solely a dopamine deficiency disorder. It has so many other origins and the whole blood, you know, is it brain, you know, gut brain or brain gut, you know, there's this hormonal element, there's the genetic element. It's actually a very complicated beast. And it just mm-hmm. highlights, you know, the complexity of doing research in this particular area, because trying to get a test that would capture perhaps hormonal, genetic, environmental risk factors would be really, really complicated. And I guess also ethically, that then also raises some challenges because, yeah. you know, it's such an intriguing condition, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point in terms of, you know, it's always bandied around that, you know, the animal studies or, you know, cell, they just use male versions. And, you know, 50%, over 50% of the population besides Parkinson's are women, you know, so you can't dismiss it just because it's difficult. You know, and I've real faith in the science community that they've done some amazing, difficult things, that surely the female body is not that difficult, you know. And, it, you know, I think one of the things was the thalidomide scare just put the whole kibosh on women's research, you know, because basically they were like, oh, my God, don't test on women. But we know through the COVID crisis that actually women who are pregnant were at a much higher risk, and it was only when they started actually researching they realized, oh my God, you know, we need to make sure they're vaccinated. So we can't shy away from it. We need to, you know, face it full on and you know, work with it. And also I think in terms of research, you know, there's this kind of like criteria that if you're a woman of childbearing age, you can't take part in study. That drives me nuts, you know. Also, it's kind of a patriarchal thing that, you know, women can't look after their own reproductive, you know, system. Say if they're going through a trial, they're not going to be trying to get pregnant, you know. But of course, obviously, there's probably, I don't know, insurance risk or something that, you know, someone's going to take them to court or something. But I definitely think there we need to start, you know, taking it into account because it reflects real world. And I think the other interesting thing in terms of studies, if you think about it, right, if a woman with Parkinson's takes part in a trial and is on a contraceptive pill, that potentially is improving her symptoms. So actually, you're not getting a real result in the study. You're getting something that has been actually affected by the hormone. So is that affecting your overall outcome of your study? And I've put that to a few researchers and they're like, oh, that's a good point. And, you know, interesting on that, because we're looking at, you know, the impact of the menstrual cycle and contraceptives. And we've actually as well, just another exciting piece of news is that we have won a grant, 200,000 grant with France Parkinson. We just got word of it. So Professor Elena Morrow is the PI, and it's looking at doing a similar study as the UCC study in 4 centres in France. Where there will be an arm of women tracking themselves, but there will be another arm of intervention. So the neurologist will actually treat whatever way they treat a woman who has worsened symptoms, and then they'll track again so we can see, does it have an impact? So that's really exciting. Now we have to kind of go through the whole, we just got the grant, we have to go through the whole ethical process. But one of the reviewers of the application kind of came back and said, what about, you know, the impact of oral contraceptive? And I started to research into it. I have to say I was just completely ignorant. There are more than just the pill, obviously. There are IUS, IUD. There is copper IUD, which basically doesn't have any hormones in it. There's IUS that only have progesterone. And there are pills that only have progesterone, no estrogen. There are estrogen only. There are so many different types. And the reality is that those different types have different impacts on neurotransmitters. So I did a survey of women. So there's 55 women in terms of the type of oral contraceptives they were on. And there was a vast range of people on IUD, IUS, you know, combined pill. But the women who didn't have symptoms around their menstrual cycle were the ones who didn't have a bleed. So didn't you know, were using combined oral contraceptive and didn't have a bleed. So that, again, fits in with not having a drop in your estrogen potentially. But that's only, that was only a subset of 9 out of 55, you know. So back to your point, Julie, of it being complicated, you know, there's also the issue in terms of the different types of hormone amounts in and how women respond. And actually, the research also, if you look at premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which actually the symptoms are very similar to Parkinson's, they're a worse form of PMS and they're very like Parkinson's. And they've actually done research there and they think that it's very similar in terms of the Parkinson's response, but they think that it might be how a woman responds to the changes in the hormones rather than necessarily the amount of drop in hormone, or that it's actually, so women with premenstrual dysphoric disorder are more sensitive. And that kind of makes fits with me in terms of Parkinson's, you know, maybe because of our neurochemistry being out of balance that we are more sensitive. And then, as you say, in terms of, you know, potential research, you know, led me down because it's all about estrogen, but actually progesterone is a really interesting hormone. And actually there has been some research to show that there is a neuroactive steroid called allopregnanolone. It's a bit of a long word, allopregnanolone. And it's an ingredient of progesterone. And they've actually used it in premenstrual dysphoric disorder. They've got an FDA approval and it radically improves women's symptoms. And actually there is some research in Parkinson's in animals to show that this particular neuroactive steroid improves symptoms in an MTP, you know, when they make the animal have Parkinson's, it actually improved their symptoms. So I just think, you know, we have to get over that it's difficult and start to, you know, really look at this. And I think there are actually more, since we came out with our paper, I've seen more and more, you know, papers now coming out looking at hormones and Parkinson's. So there is research to show that men with Parkinson's drop in their testosterone as well. And that affects cognitive function and affects mood as well in men who don't have Parkinson's. So what does that do? You know, so there's a whole area that we've ignored.
I remember even going back, my son's 23 now, and when I was pregnant, I was frightened to even take a paracetamol, to be perfectly honest. I was trying to avoid taking anything. So for women who are diagnosed either before or, like yourself, during a pregnancy, do we really know how safe Parkinson's drugs are in pregnancy?
No, we don't. And that's another huge area. So in fact, you know, what our Parkinson's colleague, Anne-Liane Oosterbaan, if you're familiar with her, she is a gynecologist. She doesn't practice anymore, but trained as a gynecologist, and she has Parkinson's. She's 4 kids, so she's actually set up a registry for pregnant women, so that we can actually, you know, get research. It's called pregspark.com. So again, we can share these, you know, links and resources for this very reason, because we need more information, and also, you know, so it's known that levodopa is seen to be safe. But other hormones like agonists, you know, I think there's a question mark. There's some research show that they are safe, some that doesn't. You know, things like, I think memantine, you can't, you know, some of the anti-dyskinesia drugs, you can't. And, you know, for some women, I think their dyskinesia just only gets a lot worse. So, yeah, it's basically, it's an unmet need that really needs to be resolved. And I think, you know, as we know, a lot of us, that a lot of people hide it because they're trying to, you know, keep their jobs. So talking to women with Parkinson's, they have actually decided not to have a child because there isn't the evidence around and they cannot face their symptoms being so bad and having been pregnant. You know, I know there's women even with cancer where there is a solution found for them and it's not treated as if you can't have a child. You know, I've heard women been told, oh, you couldn't possibly, you know, consider being pregnant with Parkinson's. But, you know, I know lots of women who cope very well. And there's many people with disabilities who cope very well with having children, you know. So I think that's a personal decision. And we need the research to enable them to make that personal decision.
That's quite a sobering note to perhaps end on, and one that really does demonstrate the desperate need that there is for far more research into the effects of Parkinson's, the disease itself, and the drugs in women.
So I think it's very important to highlight as well that Bas Bloom's team did a study there recently, that a survey of women who are postmenopausal, and it categorically showed that their symptoms were much worse than premenopausal. And that, I think, ties in with, again, the hormones, you know, affect. And I think the reason I'm raising it is we did a survey on menopausal women in terms of Parkinson's. And again, about 90% were saying that, you know, they weren't been treated for it and are not being offered HRT. That's not been discussed. And we know a lot of women do very well on HRT. For one, because it's obviously solving their menopause symptoms, which could be exacerbating the Parkinson's symptoms, or perhaps the HRT is helping the Parkinson's. We don't know. Again, the research is equivocal at the moment. But I suppose it's just anyone who's listening, you know, this is about being aware and actually asking the questions of your neurologist. If you're, you know, any way affected by hormone at stage in your life, be it, you know, premenstrual, be it pregnancy, be it perimenopause or postmenopausal. And I suppose the other thing is, and a bit of a plug for the app, is it's free. It's on the Apple Store. It's on the Google App Store. You can use that as a way. And there's actually videos, voice, and image, because obviously we get bad. Sometimes it's hard for us to type. So there's an ability for you, if you're dyskinetic, to take a video so you can prove. Because sometimes, you know, people are trying to kind of justify what they're saying, or sometimes they don't know the difference between whether it's a tremor, dyskinesia, or dystonia. So you can log those and it actually summarizes it for you. And it's in relation to your medication as well. So you can sort of see. And we didn't even get into the whole absorption of dyskinesia. Like, that is, you know, a big issue that needs to be addressed in women as well.
Wow. A huge thank you. And, you know, people like Bas Bloom and indeed many of us in the Parkinson's community have called for the need to have an MDT to manage people with Parkinson's. And I do wonder, based on some of this great work that you have been pioneering, perhaps maybe we need to add an endocrinologist to the Parkinson's team. And these are medical doctors who specialize specifically in the hormone system, and it may be that they need to be an integral part.
I know in the Bas Bloom's team, they've actually included a gynecologist now for women and access. So absolutely, you know, there needs to be sort of, it's a bit like, I think, you know, from the diet point of view, gastroenterologists need to be involved in the care of people with Parkinson's as well, you know. So it makes sense, because Parkinson's affects so many parts of our body, you know, it's not just our brain.
Yeah, a huge thank you. I've learned heaps today, Rochelle, hearing your talk. And I think the other thing that's really struck me is, I think probably thank you is required, because I think you, as somebody with Parkinson's, have raised your voice. And actually, it purely, you know, really beautifully illustrates where people stand up going, this is a problem affecting me, which has really been a catalyst for the research world to sort of take note and say, yeah, there does look like there's some trends here that, you know, and your great partnership with Indu and many of the other teams that you're working with have really taken that on board and really shed a new light on an aspect of Parkinson's that historically has never been looked at. And I think that is really interesting and hugely commendable. And I think probably there's women who are going to be listening to this podcast going, that makes a lot of sense to me. So I think a huge thank you for what you've done and you continue to do. And I think Helga and I will make sure we've got all the links on the podcast to both the app, your up and coming research studies, and perhaps some of the papers that you've published as well, where people can read more. Because I think today, I feel we've kind of scratched the surface of this issue, but I can see this is a hugely, you know, emerging area of research practice. So thank you so much for that.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.